I've always said you're not learning unless you're breaking stuff. In fact, I'm teaching an internal SEO class at Moz where I have a WordPress site. Everyone attending have their own login. I want them to break the site. I want them to push the limit and try to customize stuff or play around with it, you know, and get stuff to rank. And that's been one of the most fun things as far as planting that seed of curiosity.
Hello and welcome to the Jumpstart Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Sauer. Today for our 80th episode, we're going to talk with Brittany Muller, SEO and content architect at Moz and founder of Pride Marketing. This is one of those classic stories of a woman who grows up in Minnesota, moves to Colorado to become a ski bum, becomes an SEO expert, and then gets one of the most coveted SEO jobs on the planet. You know, pretty standard stuff. Just kidding, of course. Obviously, there's a lot to unwind from that little introduction I just made for you right there. Like, why is the state of Minnesota so awesome? Why would Brittany care about SEO when she can snowboard all day? Wait a minute, I thought Cyrus Shepherd, who you interviewed in episode 5, Jeff, was the SEO at Moz. And I promise that we will address all these questions and more during the episode. But first, I wanted to talk about Brittany Muller as a person. Now, I first came into contact with Brittany on Twitter after she heard my interview on Dan Shore's podcast. She said it was her favorite episode on the Evolving SEO podcast of all time. And I was like, what is wrong with you? Now, thankfully, I didn't actually say that out loud. I just took the compliment and I said booyah to myself, as we Minnesotans tend to say. On a side note, this is the second time in a row we've talked about Dan Shore's Evolving SEO podcast. It's a great podcast that you should also listen to. And also since then, I've been usurped as Brittany's favorite guest from that podcast and replaced by Stephanie Briggs. I think it's time for me to get Stephanie on the podcast, right? Okay, so Brittany and I met in person this summer at the MN Search Summit. And I have to say, she's equally awesome in person as her online persona. Probably even more awesome, believe it or not. Now, I'm not going to share the details of the late night shenanigans that happened after the conference, other than to say I had great chats with many future podcasts while sitting around a large German Biergarten-style table at the New Bohemia Wurst House in downtown St. Paul. Now, if you're doing the podcast thing yourself and you ever have trouble booking guests, it just turns out you need to stay up longer. Now, back to Brittany. She's awesome in person, and she's a heck of a podcast guest as well. Listen on as we talk about machine learning, the guest posting process at Moz, and some of the cool SEO experiments Brittany is running over at Moz. For show notes, visit jefflytics.com/Brittany.
Okay, cool. So now that we've 20 minutes into our podcast without actually anything to show for it, let's get into the actual recording piece of it. Thanks so much for joining me, Brittany.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Jeff.
The first question I do ask is like, what got you to break into the world of marketing? And then we'll just keep on moving into your current role, how you got that, and then like all the exciting stuff that you find.
Cool. Yeah, that sounds good. So basically, my story is a little strange just because after I graduated from college, which was University of Minnesota Twin Cities, I really couldn't find a job that I wanted. And after getting pretty frustrated, I decided to just pack up my car and drive out to Breckenridge, Colorado to be a snowboard bum for a season or two. And that was literally kind of my focus, was just to snowboard as much as physically possible. And so I was able to do that. And then I was also waiting tables at the time. And that got really old just because I had a college education and I was doing some really cool marketing stuff throughout college. And so I ended up linking up with a local realtor who would basically drive me out to these huge houses that he was listing with a lunch and leave me there. And I would write up these listings about these big homes. And I had so much fun with that. And then he introduced me to HTML and SEO. And the second I started learning about SEO and that you could figure out how many people a month are searching ski in, ski out, single family home, Peak 9 Breckenridge, my life was literally changed forever. I got super excited about that stuff, you know, just the psychology of it and how people are searching and how are people searching for homes in Keystone? Like, what does this look like? I just had way too much fun and it spilled over into all sorts of other things that as you kind of know, kind of got me into trouble very early on because I didn't know any better, you know, and I just had fun doing it. So at the time I was sort of building these websites and getting them to rank for really ridiculous things that I definitely didn't necessarily deserve to rank for, but sort of was able to game the system. And you had referenced that you had heard the story on Half Hour Intern of, you know, I'm big into snowboarding, and so I wanted to rank number one for Burton US Open day of the event. And I had prepared about 7 months in advance with all this unique content and images, and I got a press pass, and it was ridiculous, and I'd prepared all these links, and day of the event, my website ranked above Burton, and I got a call from their marketing department. And so that was sort of a funny thing, and, you know, I immediately took it down at their request and kind of explained that it was just sort of a goal of mine, a silly goal of mine to do that. But yeah, that's kind of where it all started. And I think the big key part of it is just being very, very curious. I wanted to know how this stuff worked. I wanted to know how do people influence where people go online? And that felt very powerful to me, you know, and I was alone in the mountains snowboarding every day. And this was just kind of, I got such a kick out of it. So I went crazy. And then being very competitive as well, I think helped propel it to the next level.
That's amazing. I love it. I mean, yeah. It's so, so cool. I remember my discovery moment as well. And you're just like, there's people out there who are looking for this stuff and there's a lot more than you think. And I can actually influence it. There's actually an opportunity to do that.
Yeah.
Obviously, you sort of you're learning for the real estate, and you're learning in that area, and you're applying these things. Did you Where did you go to learn that? I mean, obviously you have a mentor who's teaching you things, but how did you learn to do these things? And then how did you decide, and maybe this isn't a fair assessment, but how did you know to decide to go after like the CD type stuff versus some of the more mainstream things? Was it just convenience or just your influences?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I think initially I was introduced to this concept of SEO via the real estate thing, where I was doing a lot of content on ActiveRain, one of the biggest real estate blogging platforms, and took an SEO course through ActiveRain, and then was just sort of hooked. And then through Twitter, I was able to connect with an SEO digital marketer over in Vail, Rich Stats. So Rich and I teamed up, and he hired me onto his agency, and he taught me a ton of stuff. So he introduced me to Whiteboard Friday,
nice.
To all that stuff. So the second I had my hands on all these resources, I mean, I just kind of went nuts. And he was so incredible because it was sort of like, we need to know the best of the best information, and we're not going to let anything stand in our way to do that. So I was I was in the first class that Garrett French ever taught about link building. I was immediately put on like Eric Ward's link building list, which I don't know if I'm supposed to say, cause it's like kind of the private list whatever.
Yeah. I'm on that one too.
Yeah. It's awesome. But just knowing about, you know, those two individuals who are sort of the grandfathers of link building and getting introduced to their tactics and what works very, very early on and sort of putting all these pieces together, it allows the stuff to sort of click into place in your head. Because without understanding that full ecosystem of search and digital marketing, you can get lost and you can get hung up on stuff that doesn't push the needle.
Yeah, for sure.
So I think that was, I got really lucky in a lot of those aspects.
Yeah, it's cool. I mean, I think a lot of us are sort of the sum of our mentors that provide us that information or the direction they put us in and the sources they share with us.
Yeah.
The other thing that's interesting is I know a lot of people who start out in the same way, like they'll be working with a charismatic person or somebody who's, you know, good at what they do. And they're like, hey, a lot of times their problem is that they don't have enough time to get it done. It's no longer worthwhile for them to go and look at, you know, to find links, you know, so they want to find somebody to do it. But a lot of times people will just focus purely on the outcome at hand. It's like, how do I get links and how do I just be done with this? It sounds like you poured yourself into not just that, but the entire psychology that goes behind it, right? The whole what's going on? Why do I need links? Why are these things important to us right now?
Exactly. I remember making cold calls for link building. Like, I remember doing that for camps in Minnesota and how ridiculous it felt, but how rewarding it was to get one or two of them, you know? And I think you have to have sort of that drive and that curiosity to do a lot of that stuff. And you have to put yourself out there. I think a lot of digital marketers or just anyone in tech, it's really easy to hide behind a computer. Mm-hmm. You know, it takes a whole nother kind of person to really put yourself out there. And I just decided to do that early on because I felt like there was the only way to learn more, to get farther ahead, and to sort of propel my career in this.
Yeah.
And I hear this all the time. So many of us are basically attending MozCon from Twitter. I did that for years and I was just dying to go and I couldn't afford it. You know, I was kind of living paycheck to paycheck in the mountains and I made a video. And this is so hilarious because so many of my coworkers to this day at Moz still don't know that I did this. And I'm afraid that if I tell them, they're going to put it together and be like, oh, like you were the poor girl who made that video for us way back in the day. That was pathetic. We all felt so bad for you. And they gave me a very heavily discounted ticket and I soaked everything in like a sponge, you know, and the second I would see Will Critchlow or Mike King, I would drop everything and just run over to them mm-hmm. and introduce myself and ask them questions. And I think it just, you know, it really takes that like face to face too, to make some of those connections.
Yeah. That's fascinating. I mean, that was what I was going to ask you is like, why go above and beyond? I mean, I think some people have it inside of them that they're just like, this is it. I'm a career maker and this is an opportunity. Sometimes it's the being broke, you know, or living paycheck to paycheck that like necessity is a mother of invention, but it sounds like it's fun because like we haven't really talked about this before, but it's like you go to Colorado to be a ski bum and sort of like take it easy, take it slow. And then suddenly it doesn't seem like it's that long. You're just like, now you're like, hey, I'm in. I'm all in on this SEO thing.
Yeah, totally. I think, I don't know. I've always sort of been 0 to 60, you know, like if I start tinkering with something and I'm interested, I'm all in. And as far as sort of getting that motivation to go to MozCon and to meet these people I had basically stalked for 3 years. You know, I knew everything about all of them because I just religiously followed them on Twitter to a fault. You know, I knew their pets' names. I knew what kind of cupcakes they liked. I knew ridiculous facts about all these people. And the funny thing was, is I didn't go to MozCon to meet them to like get ahead in the industry. Like I genuinely adored these people and respected them and really, I mean, I still just respect the hell out of all of them and look up to all of them. And so it was more of just, like I had to see them in person. It was like, I was just that fan.
Yeah,
you know?
For sure. It's like a level that you achieved. Like you unlocked the next level when you got there and it validates a lot of things too.
Exactly. And I think it was funny because most of them, like I remember Will Critchlow, I had stalked him so much online that when I walked right up to him at MozCon and, you know, it was like, hey, how you doing, Will? He just assumed we had met before and I rolled with it. I was like, and I'm freaking out. I'm like, oh my gosh, it's Will Critchlow. This is insane. And he's just like, how are you?
I love it. And that's funny because I think that a lot more people develop that than probably is let on. That we learn a lot about people through the internet and you can have these relationships.
Yeah.
And so conferences are interesting because it's a way to solidify that relationship or to build it. But then sometimes I agree, I've done that before where I like know way too much about a person. And I think I did that this weekend, actually. I was talking to this guy, Brennan Dunn, and I was like, talking about his career and he's like, how do you know this? And I was like, well, all your marketing is basically about how you did this. And so I took your story and like merged it into my own. And then I built this persona for you. That's a little bit forward for a first time meeting somebody, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, that's so funny. I love that.
I'm curious, and this is something that I've always been thinking about. And actually, I just did an interview with John Doherty. It'll go live before this one. But he was in the mountains of Switzerland, and he had a task to learn SEO, and then it became his obsession as well. And so now I have two data points where people are like in a setting that And obviously there's one thing, which is to ski, which can take up a lot of your time, you know, but is there something about being isolated or being in a community where you have free time that accelerates your learning, or that made this happen? Is that something that was, would you factor that in there? Like being a study, or having time to study what other people are doing?
Oh, absolutely. There was no distractions for me. You know, it was the first time I didn't have a TV. We basically had to burn wood to keep the place warm where I lived. And I remember I knitted hundreds of scarves that winter as well. Like there just wasn't much to do, you know, aside from go to the bars and get drunk, which just really was never my thing either, you know? So I took to this stuff like crazy, and it was so fun for me. And I think there is this strange, almost sick fascination of having some sort of power and being so remote and not feeling like you have influence over things. And then you see that you're able to influence search and where people are visiting things online. And it's just rewarding. It honestly just turned into a giant game for me. And to this day, it's still a giant game. And I'm still learning new tricks. It's like chess, you know? So I love it so much.
Well, I mean, it's almost like being in these, whether you call it rural, whether you call it cold, since you and I are both from the cold state of Minnesota, you're from like the northern part, though, it sounds like. So you had it even worse than me. But even like I was in Finland, and there's amazing marketers there. I think that there must be something about being cold and then having this relative isolation that just makes us want to, you know, prove it out. And then the internet is the great equalizer, because you can develop a voice and you can do a lot from those locations, for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Huh. So, I mean, getting back to the story about Burton and everything else, I like it. It basically sounds like everything that you're doing is really just, okay, now that I learned a little bit, I want to see what I can do about it. And it's like, how powerful is this? So it actually goes back to being able to, you know, to being isolated and to have, you know, extra time to study. What do you do? What do you do with it? And so.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, I mean, this stuff started infiltrating every aspect of my day. I remember even when I was on the mountain, I was thinking about weird stuff. Like, I wonder how many people search Britney Spears a month. Like, you know, like stupid thoughts like that were just constantly flowing through my head of like, oh, I can't wait to look this up, or I wonder how this works, or I wonder who ranks for this. So it just started to become this obsession. And then once I realized that, oh my gosh, people will pay me to do this. And then that sort of spilled over into, oh shit, like I can actually help really good people who own businesses, and they really deserve to rank. They really deserve this traffic. They deserve more customers. That's when you really get rewarded, you know, is when you can start to see that happen.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that's the cool thing. Cause then once you have some success and some, you know, studies or, hey, I ranked number one for this, which is very difficult, then it puts you on the map, and then you can start to, you can figure out now the problems change from boredom to scaling or to bring in, you know, how do I turn this into a business? How do I turn this into the career move? So how did you do that?
I honestly, I think it was a perfect storm. And I don't know if John would maybe confirm this as well, like being in the mountains, but it was a perfect storm for me because I was in a small mountain town. We were in Vail, you know, I was working with Rich, and we were able to move the needle so quickly on these small local businesses because it was a small mountain town. No one knew how to do SEO at the time. No one was able to do the things that we were aware of. And so we were able to sort of build up this confidence that maybe we didn't necessarily deserve right away because we saw those changes shift so quickly. So I think if I had been in a big city where maybe it was already sort of, you know, tough to do some of this stuff, or I would have gotten a little discouraged, but it wasn't like that at all. I was able to do relatively, you know, little link building, little content, and really start to see those changes.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's an interesting perspective too, because I think that if you're in a big community and there's jobs readily available, what will end up happening is it at a young age you get hired in, and then they try to indoctrinate you into how they do things. They try to they try to teach you how everything goes, and they want to make you a cog in the wheel, if you will. Versus if you start your own business, then you get to wear all the hats. You get to see everything, and especially when you're teamed up with somebody who's super charismatic or super knowledgeable, it totally accelerates your ability to learn things. And so in a year, you can have the equivalent of 3 years of experience at least doing that.
Yeah. Oh, exactly. That's such a great point.
Funny. So basically the moral of this one is move to the mountains, because you'll get to ski by day and you'll get to build an empire by night.
Totally. So many great companies have come out of Breckenridge since I was up there. So many people that I was friends with have gone on to build really incredible things. So yeah, I think it is something, there's something to be said about that for sure.
Well, I like that. I mean, the funny thing is, I think people have a perception that if you say I'm a ski bum, or I'm just doing this, that's all they do, or that they're not focusing on things. But I agree. I know I've met many people who have this passion for the mountains or passion for doing whatever they do, whether it's ultra marathons or you know, anything that's time consuming and creates a perception. But it's like they still spend time doing things. And I'm always impressed by that, because a lot of people, they think that all they should be doing is working. But it's like you can have both.
Exactly. I think that's such an attractive quality in anyone, is that passion to just do what it is that you're crazy about, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So how do you, what do you do now? What do you do, not right now, like as we talk, but like, what do you do after you learn about marketing? Do you go out on your own? I know you as your current role, but what do you do after that?
Yeah. So after about a year at Secret Stash Media, was the awesome name.
I do like that name.
We had so much fun. I know. And the logo's even better. It's a mustache. Rich is the coolest. After about a year, I was having a hard time making things work just as far as like paycheck to paycheck. And the agency was so small, there wasn't a lot of room for growth at the time. And so unfortunately I had to sort of break off, and I didn't really intend to break off and do my own thing. I wasn't really even sure what I was going to do, but we had a medical client who was really upset that I was thinking of leaving, and we had kind of made this decision that I could take them on as a single client. And so when I left, I did that, and I just kind of went nuts with their website and with their content marketing, and that turned into word of mouth, and it grew into quite a few contracts for me. So I ended up moving down to Denver, solidifying, you know, half a dozen contracts with private practice doctors, and hiring a staff of 6.
Wow.
So, and it all happened really quickly, probably too quickly. You know, it was like, I didn't really know how to build a business. I just knew how to do the technician part really, really well. Mm-hmm. I am the stereotypical e-myth, like to a fault.
Yeah.
You know, like has a hard time delegating and all that stuff. So I learned so, so much, and we had an absolute blast, and the company did really well, but we couldn't keep doing what we were doing and necessarily feel great about it, because we had fallen into the cosmetic surgery space. Mm. And I remember it's very lucrative, but I mean, even after a year, our team was like, what are we doing? You know, none of us were feeling really great about it. And we decided to scale something that also didn't go very well. And then I was sort of reaching that stereotypical burnout. And I swear Rand has some sixth sense, and he picked up on that at a conference and sort of let me know that Cyrus was leaving, and that, you know, it would be cool if I could apply, but if not, no worries type of a thing. And I just thought, I've got nothing to lose. We kind of all needed a change. And so went through that whole process, and then was offered a job at Moz.
That's pretty great. That's a good resolution to it. I mean, obviously, you know, that's a quick way of going, you know, through 4 years of your life, you know, going through that process. And it's like, this is what happens all the time. You mentioned the e-myth, and that's exactly what ends up happening, is that just because we're good at something doesn't mean that we're good business owners. And I think that's a difficult transition for people to make, or a mental transition, because you have so much positives in one area, And then in order to build a successful business, you almost have to like disregard that, what you're good at, and focus on being a good business owner.
Yeah, totally.
So that, I mean, I have the same exact experience, you know, so that's close to the heart. I think that a lot of us have that experience. And that's something I talk about a lot on the podcast and in my courses and stuff like that too, is how do you deal with that? How do you manage that piece? But I think that, you know, even in your position now, if you decided after all the experience with Moz and working in that position, you'd be better off and much better equipped to do it again if you wanted to.
Right. And I'm well aware of the things I'm not good at and that I absolutely hate versus what I want to be doing on a day-to-day basis. So yeah, I think I would have a much, much better kind of idea of how to do that moving forward.
Awesome. So you get this job at Moz, which is the dream job for an SEO, right?
Yeah.
It's like probably the top titles you can get. It's got to be pretty high up there. So what do you do there?
So I do internal SEO and content architecture for Moz as a website. And then I'm also sort of a brand evangelist. So doing tons of conferences this year, speaking on behalf of Moz and trying to really expand skill sets that I've been trying to pick up and polish up at Moz. And I love sharing, you know, the things I'm doing at Moz, the tests I'm running, and how some of that stuff is going. Because I know the one thing I love about our industry is everyone is so transparent about what's working and what's not for the most part. You know, we're all on Twitter sharing tests and studies and all this fun stuff. So I think just continuing to provide back to the community like that has been one of the best parts of this entire gig.
Yeah, for sure. It's a pretty strong community too. So yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's the highest ranking post on Moz for Google Analytics? The most traffic.
The most traffic. So I should know this off the top of my head because I just built a data driven blog sitemap.
Nice.
Last week. So I was looking at all of that and I decided to go, I went back 90 days and I pulled all blog posts that had at least over, was it like 20 visits? So that would obviously go back in time and the stuff that was working really well. And then just for fun, I remember I was searching by time. So what's the post that people have spent the most time on? You're not going to believe this. I'm blanking on his name. Who did the Obama campaign A/B testing stuff?
Dan Thoreaker?
No.
Somebody else wrote about it, I think. But that's
Kyle Rush.
Okay.
Is it Kyle Rush? Does that sound right? I think that's his name. I can double check. He wrote about that whole test and the whole experience. And people spent over 15 minutes on that blog post still. And that kind of really blew me away because it's for sure one of the outliers on the Moz blog. It's just filled with so many great takeaways, the A/B tests that they did to increase donations, the form testing and how he shortened things and made the little progress bar at the top, all that stuff. So that was really, really cool to see.
Yeah, yeah. It was Kyle Rush. I just looked it up.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, thank you.
It's funny because I sat in one of those from the 2008 campaign, and the guy who was in charge of it for 2008 ended up creating Optimizely. So like the A/B testing tool.
Wow.
And that's the Dan Thoreaker guy. So it's funny how.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So that's pretty amazing. And actually, Kyle looks like he works there now too. So that's wild.
Oh my gosh, that's so funny.
Yeah, so they parlayed that into a software company.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Well, I was asking you a leading question because I was hoping you were going to say me. But I have this post that I wrote like 2 or 3 years ago on the Moz blog about like content and Google Analytics content analysis. And I get like comments on it still, and it always shows up in search. So, and even, I have a slide share embedded and that thing has like 70,000 views or something like that now. So I was just wondering if.
Oh my gosh. Wait, and what was it called?
Advanced Content Analysis in Google Analytics.
Okay. Yeah.
I was hoping that you'd say, well, it's obviously you, Jeff, and you need to write again. You haven't written in 2 years. So,
yeah.
So I was going to commit on the air to writing something for Moz. And then
Oh my gosh. I would love that. We would all love that. So something that I was looking for on the blog yesterday, and I really didn't find much, and I wanted to ask you about was Google Analytics reports and creating really customized like SEO reporting, there is such an opportunity for a post and resources. Anything around that, I think, would be so incredible for the blog.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask if you had a course for that or if you offer stuff like that.
I do. I mean, my courses talk about, well, it's more like where to find all the reports and then what the data tells you and what it doesn't tell you. And so It's a lot of like how you can build your own reports. But and we show where to find like other custom dashboards and stuff. But I like that idea of creating a blog post around like SEO reports in Google Analytics. Today.
I think that would be so powerful.
I think a lot of them are very out of date or they don't keep up with what data Google allows you to have.
Yeah, and I think that's something that maybe we don't talk enough about in the industry is just, you know, kind of that client hand-holding and what the expectations are and that constant flow of communication of what's being done, reporting, you know, because a lot of the stuff we do as SEOs, you can't see necessarily. And I remember getting really frustrated with some of that stuff with a few clients where we were working our butts off, but because we were spending all this time optimizing, compressing their images, rewriting the titles and alt and all that stuff, they weren't seeing it. And so we had to sit them down and explain what it was that we were doing, which is sort of a frustrating aspect of this job. Mm-hmm. But I think reporting can really solve for so much of that.
I love it. I will, I'll put something together. I think I got a really good idea for how we can do that. So, I might actually be done with it by the time it goes live, but we'll have to see.
That would be so awesome. Yeah. And people love your posts, by the way. I'm in GA and oh my gosh, people spend an average of over five minutes on it, which is really high for our posts.
Nice.
So, yeah.
Well, there we go.
Nice work.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's funny. Like, that's something about being part of the community. I mean, obviously, this is part of your job, too. It's like, I noticed that if I write something for Moz, the process that I went through as a writer is like you. If you have a actually, I don't want to get into how to get onto the Moz blog. Like, you have to have relationships usually or something that's really super compelling. But once you get in, it's not just like you write a post. Like, some places you do a guest post. They will just take it and put it up there live. The team, actually, I think it was Trevor that I was working with. He's like, I want to change this. I need to change this. You're not specific enough on this one. And actually, case, he told me that the article wasn't good enough for Moz. The one before that wasn't good enough, and I ended up self-publishing it. And actually, it happened twice, and they were like my highest trafficked articles. So that's cool in itself. But I like how there's editorial control, and that it's that you're going through it in order to help everybody out. You know, you're helping your readers, you're helping the person for search traffic, you're helping so many different aspects of it, and it's a lot more than just a simple write something and then it automatically gets published. I like the editorial part of it for sure.
Yeah. Oh, that's such great feedback. I love that.
And also I like that when you put something on there, you'll rank. And so you know, compared to if you write it on, if you self-publish it, I think that's something that a lot of entrepreneurs or people who are just getting started, they are concerned about, because they don't, like, if they write the best article in the world, will it get noticed? And it may if you promote it really well, but it also doesn't have that inherent like automatic pickup that might come with something from Moz, for example.
Exactly. Like your post, for example, over 80% of it comes from organic, which is incredible.
Nice. Yeah, I don't think it would do nearly as well if it was self-published by any means.
Right. That's so interesting. And I think from, you know, a content perspective, you can get so strategic with sort of that sense of control of, okay, what do people really like? What are they looking for? What authors do the best? And I think you said it best on Experts on the Wire podcast with Dan Schur when you were talking about how you can sort and filter all of that stuff if you have tags in place. Mm-hmm. Right? Wasn't that through Google Tag Manager?
Yeah, you can.
And then you're able to see.
Yeah, if you're in WordPress, which most people are, you can put all your, you could do your category. You could make that a custom dimension.
Yeah.
You could do your tags. You could do the title sequence or like whatever your URL structure is. Like, I have Google Analytics and a lot of URLs. I could group those together. We put word count in there. That's super easy to do. And those are, I think actually a lot of that's part of the Moz post where I talk about how to do that. But that's probably due for an update as well, actually, because I think there's even more you can do and you can take it even further.
I love that so much. And so I listened to that podcast of yours on Experts on the Wire several times, and I sent it to the whole content team at Moz because I'm like, we have to do this. You know, like it would be so interesting to see where, you know, what Twitter prefers, what kind of content they prefer versus Facebook, or just even visits in general and retention and all this stuff. But the things that I think I run into, and I think a lot of people run into, is just developer kind of roadblocks, yep. You know? So there are reasons in place why I can't just add Google Tag Manager. We actually already have a tag manager in place, and it's not that easy mm-hmm. to add new tags. So I guess I'm super curious, like, what would you tell people that sort of run into these dev roadblocks that want to be doing that, some of that stuff?
Yeah, it's funny. Well, I'm being interviewed now. This is great. Turn the tables.
I'm so curious.
That's perfect. So I always look at it as like I'm a developer by trade. And so a lot of it comes down to it's problem solution. So you try something, you try the easiest thing and then it doesn't work. And then you need to get creative and you need to just keep on going through your decision tree until you get to it. That's actually how programming a computer works too, right? If this, then that. And so like if they give you unfettered access to Google Tag Manager or you're the administrator of WordPress, you just put code on your site and it's there. If you don't get that, then you need to say, okay, well, how else are people getting tags onto websites and how does this work? A lot of times what ends up happening is development resources, I always say that their job is to manage risk. So anybody in the IT department, I'm doing air quotes, you can't see it because this is a podcast, but anybody in the IT department, which is sort of condescending to call them IT because it's like they're so much more specialized in that, but their job is to control risk. And so at the end of the day, they're evaluated by nobody breached security, nobody stole the data, nobody broke into it. And so their immediate response to anything that anybody does is no. And that's rightfully so, because no means no risk. Yes means you're opening up the door to risk. And so the way that you turn that no into a yes is to demonstrate to them how you're reducing their risk. And then also, if you can create a big enough business case that this is actually not just risk, it's a worthwhile use of our resources. Another thing I've noticed about IT departments development is that they're budgeted almost never. They're treated as an expense, as a cost center. They're almost never budgeted by the revenue they generate. And so because we don't think of it as a revenue generating area, we think of it as a risk reduction area. And so how do you create an argument, maybe not to them, but to their superior or to a C-suite level person in your company, that this resource that you're paying X, if you can implement this, you're going to be able to double your site traffic, or you're going to be able to see a 20% increase in traffic. And with that 20% increase in traffic, with you know, in the example of Moz, we get this many signups, we know our lifetime value, we can make $1 million by doing this. That's a pretty compelling argument, and there's almost no reason why somebody wouldn't do that. But most of the time, we approach solutions in a different way. What we end up doing is we say, we want this because we need it or we think it's cool. And all that you're doing is opening up risk, and you're not actually presenting an argument. And so that's how I found that almost everything that I go through that I try to resolve, it's like you just need to level with people as to what are their motivations. And then also you need to be pretty honest with yourself about what you're going to get out of it. And then is it a battle that you want to fight?
Right. That's such a good point. I just think there's also other things though, like an example is I really want our dev team at Moz to create a capture for all Googlebot visits to our server. But because we have a load balancer, we're not really capturing that all that well. Okay. So they would have to kind of cache it a different way. And so I've been kind of on them to enable this for me to see what the heck's going on when Googlebot gets to our site, how many errors are they encountering, all that good stuff. And it's just, they see it as extra work. And I can't really quantify what that would do, you know, what I would, because I have no idea what I would see. So I think there's also stuff like that where I just like get super frustrated or, you know, don't have the right sort of leverage or value that it would contribute to
that's a tough one.
Sort of launch that.
What I usually end up doing in that case is I will and I happen to be technical. Sometimes people don't consider themselves technical. That scares the crap out of them. But I'll just do it on my own site. Like I didn't implement the custom dimensions on Moz. Like I created Jeffalytics purely as a test ground because I didn't have a data set that I could work with without screwing it up. And so I basically was like, well, if I screw up my own stuff, which I do all the time, I constantly screw up Jeffalytics. Like I break it. I'm so embarrassed by how dumb I am with my own analytics.
I love that.
But that's why I created it because I was like, and that's why I started writing content because I was like, well, if I don't have any traffic, then I can't really come to conclusions. And then I was like, well, I'm just write about these experiments. And that was what I ended up doing in order. That was what the blog became. It's like write about the stuff I'm doing on the blog.
Yes,
I've sort of fallen off a little bit on that. But that was how I was able to try things out. And also, I think it makes you so much. I mean, you, obviously, Moz doesn't do consulting, but it makes you so much more valuable as a consultant or as somebody who provides services or even like in your content. Like you could write an article on it. And then bam, then that article gets all this traffic. And then people are like, well, why aren't we doing this at Moz? And so it's sort of like that's a little bit further down the decision tree is like, if nobody will even give you the time of day, then do it on your own in a much lower risk environment.
Totally prove it. I've always said you're not learning unless you're breaking stuff. I absolutely love that. In fact, I'm teaching an internal SEO class at Moz later today, where I have a WordPress site, everyone attending, I think there's 20 some people attending, they'll all have their own login. I want them to break the site. I want them to push the limit and try to customize stuff or play around with it, you know, and get stuff to rank. And that's been one of the most fun things as far as working internally with all these incredible coworkers is sort of planting that seed of curiosity. And the only way I've been able to do it is to find out what people are really interested in and then somehow connect it to SEO.
Yeah.
So we have someone who internally at Moz who doesn't do anything with the products. They're sort of, they're on Team Happy, so they help with HR and all this stuff. But I found out that he's really into fashion and he loves all this stuff. And yesterday he found out that his post from a couple months ago ranks number 5 for Met Gala Hall of Fame. And he was running around the office telling everyone about it. You know, it was like this hilarious thing. And he's worried that the Kardashians are going to see it. And he's freaking out. And then he's sharing that. Trevor from our content team is like, oh my gosh, I rank really well for eat caramel for dinner. Like, so you start to get them all excited about these weird little things that they love. And it's just, it's a hoot. Like seeing them get so excited because that's what it is, you know, is connecting that back to something and sort of connecting the dots on like how that stuff
works. Yeah, for sure. And it's amazing to see that because like it's funny. There's like the stuff that you intend to rank for and then there's the unintended consequences or benefits that are out there too. Like eating caramel for dinner. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's incredible.
And that's what gets people interested. And I think that obviously any company is better off to have everybody invested versus nobody. So I like that you're doing an internal training. Is that a pretty big part of what you do in your role? Or do you have to force it? Is that something that the company harbors?
So I started harboring it because I started getting frustrated at there is a lack of SEO knowledge internally at Moz. And that was something that sort of came as a shock to me when I first started. And I saw it spilling over into all these other areas because we've got people writing content for products that maybe aren't real familiar with what that feature is necessarily used for. We've got, you know, photographers and different aspects of the team who don't necessarily need to be SEOs, but should have a basic understanding of SEO. So I'd continue to sort of advocate internal SEO learning. And this was sort of my own responsibility as well as the SEO was to teach some of this stuff and to inspire that curiosity and some of that, just those aspects that go along with SEO. So yeah, I've been really excited to do that. And I've seen some really cool results come from it.
I think that's cool. I mean, I think about the power of having 30 people interested in your job or at least casually interested in your job versus having just you. Like think about how much more they can do. And if you get 15 minutes of their time once a month, you basically just got yourself a whole day of productivity that you're not, and not just productivity, but perspective. Yes. Perspective that you can't bring to the table as one person. And so I teach that in one of my courses about how you should get your whole team on board with whatever your objective is, because even if they never want to do that role, or if they never want to be interested in it, they can think about it and they can approach it from a different perspective, from a different angle that others don't have.
Exactly.
That's cool.
Exactly. Yeah.
I like that a lot. So, and that's, I mean, obviously that's one part of your role. We've gotten pretty deep into like the content and the analytics. It seems like it's an ideal role because you have a huge testing ground, you know, like just sort of how I was talking about, I like to do experiments on my own site because there's not a lot of risk, you know, but I think that as you get bigger, there's more risk, but then there's also bigger data sets so you can make a bigger impact.
Exactly.
So how do you prioritize what you're going to do? It sounds like you're going into your analytics a lot. Like, how do you get these ideas? Do you use the same tools that everybody else does? Do you have internal tools? How do you ideate as to what's the best use of your time next?
Yeah, that's such a good question. And I sort of weigh it with what's going to give us the highest ROI potentially. So that's something I talked about a little bit at MozCon was, you know, evaluating all of these site issues and really focusing my time on what would have the biggest return for Moz.com. And so one of those things initially, and I'm still working on different aspects of this, was to get rid of all of the thin, spammy content pages that we had on the site, which were these bot-created profile pages.
Oh, yeah.
And I had no idea why they were indexed, why they were ranking so well. It drove me insane. And so I came up with a plan with our dev team to basically, we meta no index, no follow any profile under 200 community points.
Okay.
And so that really allowed us to sort of clean out some of that cruft that you've heard people talking about lately. And it did really well for our site traffic, for our rankings. I just felt like overall it really started to allocate some of our page authority in general. So things like that could really, you know, that are relatively low effort and makes a huge impact across the site, I will look at first and foremost. So another thing being, you know, like site maps. So, and before I jump to that, something that I have gotten so many emails about in regards to eliminating that crappy content on your site with a meta no index is people are blocking those pages on robot text files. And then they're emailing me saying, hey, like, I don't know what you're talking, like, this isn't working. It's still in search, because they're blocking bots from crawling those meta no index, no follows.
So it doesn't take hold.
It doesn't work. Yes, exactly. So you can't be blocking it on robot text. And I actually kept, we had a profile sitemap that has since been removed because we don't really need it now that it's all been crawled. I don't know, maybe I'll add it later, but I don't think it's fully necessary. But I had that in place for a while after we did all the meta no index, no follow, because I needed that to all be crawled. I needed that to be, you know, acknowledged and kind of respected by Googlebot. So I think that is one of these sort of examples of doing technical SEO, but also knowing those weird little nuances like that to get it accomplished.
Yeah, it's like sculpting what's there.
And
pruning. Like I this has been a big thing for me lately. And I think I had mentioned in our little pre-interview about how I'm going to start doing the purge. I might have already done the Purge podcast. I'm not sure yet. But basically, like, why, you know, 80-20ing your website, 80-20ing your life, like everything in general can benefit from saying what's bringing us the results. And then I think that 80-20 sometimes is even misleading, because I think from an SEO perspective, getting, you know, if you have a crawl budget where only a certain number of pages are going to get crawled, and you only let the good ones out there, and you let Google concentrate, you know, you give them more signal, then it's going to not just give you 80% of your results, it's going to give you 150% of your results.
Right, exactly.
That's really cool. Yeah. So it sounds like you have this great testing ground and this vast repository of data that you can start to pick low-hanging fruit. And I would assume that on a bigger site, you just have more fruit and more low-hanging fruit. And so it just keeps on going.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, no, it really does. And I think there's so much to be said about doing SEO for a large site that is so different than doing SEO for a small business. You know, you're going to use a lot more SQL than you would for a small business website. And you're just going to need to involve a development team a lot more than you would if you were sort of a nimble team working on small businesses. But it does definitely give the freedom to experiment and test things. So it's fun because just even in my spare time, I enjoy testing really silly, ridiculous things. Like recently I've been testing whether or not comment links are sending any sort of value, right? They're nofollow, but they're on the Moz blog and they're comment links. And I've proven that they actually do send some value. And that's equally like terrified and inspired some people on our content team. You know, like, how do I go about sharing this information?
I don't know if you want to publish that one.
I know, but it's crazy because, you know, we so often believe that nofollow links, you know, shouldn't pass any sort of authority, but I'm seeing that they do, you know, so I think it's continuing to test those basics.
Yeah, exactly. That's what drew me into Moz in the first place was Rand was doing these experiments with stuff and creating his own primary research as opposed to just like conventional wisdom. And then, you know, I think that a lot of people's thoughts on SEO come down to just a handful of sources that do this. And then it just gets perpetuated and it goes on for years that people believe this is still it. Yet the algorithm changes 500 times a year or whatever the number is, you know, it's changing daily. So how could we expect that's going to be there? And so I think there's a lot of value in primary research.
Exactly. And I think they're just going to get so much better and better and better as far as, I mean, they know what pages are fulfilling searchers' queries. You know, we've seen that at conferences when we do those awesome tests where we all, hundreds of us, will search one specific thing, click on something low on page one, and it immediately goes up to the number one spot. So we know that machine learning's in place to make all this stuff better. But, you know, in the meantime, it's still super interesting to kind of challenge those norms.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, actually, that's something I wanted to ask you about. I know we're getting towards the end of our time, but about machine learning and how that factors in to this. Have you done any experiments on that? You mentioned that you can do live ones and stuff like that. Is there any learnings there?
I am obsessed with machine learning in general, and I have been for a while. So you can sort of, I don't want to say hack, because that has such a negative connotation. You can find your way into Harvard CS109 data course if you do a little bit of searching. And it's on GitHub, and I've taken it a couple times. I've even emailed some of the TAs, and they've emailed me back. That's how ridiculous this has gotten. But they basically walk you through the basics, linear regression, basic statistical modeling, and then they use TensorFlow, a little bit of Theano, which I guess isn't really around anymore. But and even TensorFlow, if you're interested in, you know, understanding machine learning and playing with data sets, go check it out because they've got some really, really simple tutorials where you can enable a neural network on your computer in probably, I would say, less than 20 minutes. And it's not going to be anything super sophisticated. So one of the ones I have on my computer is image recognition for hand-drawn numbers. So within a 99.3% accuracy, it can tell me back what a handwritten number is of, like what number that is. And it's fun because then once you get the hang of building your own models, you can experiment with all sorts of stuff and then just watch that loss curve. So the whole goal is to get that loss curve really low. But you'll notice that neural networks have to get like dumber before they get smarter, right? They're actually layers that are training itself. And it's just mesmerizing to kind of latch onto and start to learn about. But I think fundamentally what a lot of people don't necessarily understand right now is that in order to do anything machine learning, you need huge data sets, huge amounts of labeled data that you can then train a model with. Without that, you can't do much of anything. So that's why you see, you know, websites like Kaggle doing all those competitions with data scientists to, you know, provide those data sets and then hope that people come out with really powerful algorithms based on that. But I think that's where we're going to just continue to see Google blow up this field, because they have access to the world's data.
Yes, they do.
You know, and they're constantly, they do. It's insane. And they're, you know, I dream of the day when they release data sets like libraries, you know, we could just download pet recognition, like a Anaconda library, you know, that would be incredible. So I think hopefully we start to move in that direction and it maintains its sort of open source access. But there's so many implications and so many implications for digital marketers. I mean, you start talking about natural language processing and some of the algorithms that are writing full articles that aren't terrible. It's starting to get a little dangerous, right?
Yeah.
And I see it going towards, and I think I was talking to Dr. Pete about this a couple months ago, but, you know, imagine if we could create a model that basically evaluated current search results and your individual page that you want to rank, and it starts to do some of that stuff for you. Like, that's not a crazy idea, right? So there's just so many applications. I think machine learning in general is just going to completely change our worlds in the next couple of years.
Yeah, for sure. And it's going to happen a lot faster than people think. I mean, it's already happening in many ways in search results, and it's happening in, you know, healthcare. It's going to have applications everywhere. It's funny. I've always said that, and I don't know if machine learning is the same as I'd include it in the analytics bucket, but I've always told people that take my classes that analytics is a 50-year career. And you know, maybe Google Analytics won't be around forever. You know, marketing analytics, that's like the just barely scratching the surface. But then analytics and data sets, I mean, there's just so much data being collected and available. And that once these data sets make it available, or they're easy, and once the tools become easier to use, or once you decide to take the Harvard CS class, then you can do a lot, and you can do so much. And so I'm definitely bullish on where it's going to go. And I think that it's just like anything, like you can either wait until it's present, or you can start to become, you can engross yourself in it now and create more opportunities in the future.
Exactly. And this might be getting a little crazy, but I often think about the implications of VR and MR, right? So imagine you're shopping for a sofa or a coffee table, and you can instantly see it in your living room. You can see the color. You start to react to different things in real time in VR. And as marketers, what if we start to obtain that data, right? What if we know what you're attracted to? What if we know what scares you? What if we start to collect these other sort of like deeper data sets? That's where I think it can be terrifying, right? And like super efficient in the right environment. But I'm constantly thinking of, you know, as we move forward, how are we going to optimize for VR? How is this going to work? So I think just kind of keeping those lines of thought open and running is going to be super, super interesting as we move forward.
Yeah, it's going to be a whole different world than what we recognize within 10 years. We won't be driving. Yeah. We won't have cash. We won't have credit cards. Yeah. We won't have, you know, we won't have to even, you can order something on Amazon and it'll show you what it will look like in your house, right? Or maybe we don't need to order something. Maybe there's a rental service that just gives it to you the time you need it, or you know, everything is just like the furniture is moving itself. Who knows?
Yeah.
But yeah, there's definitely gonna be a lot of crazy things happening and it's not that far away.
It's so wild. Yeah, that's really interesting.
That's awesome. Well, I think it's a bright future, but I think it's also a scary one at the same time when you don't know what's going on. So it'd be fun to revisit this one when the time comes and see your thoughts. I think you're a pioneer.
Thank you, Jeff. You're a pioneer.
Working on it, right? Slowly but surely. Okay, so we're getting near the end of our time. This has been awesome. I think we get to talk for like 10 hours. I'll give you a chance to answer the new question. That is, Is there anything that you're looking to purge as you move forward? Like something that you're like, hey, this is, I'm going to 80-20 something, whether it's at your job or life or anything.
Ooh, that's such a good question. So I feel like I did just purge my life because I basically got rid of most of my stuff and moved to Seattle and I'm living in this houseboat. So that was a really great step for me. And just the lack of clutter has been so rewarding. I think professionally and in this industry, there's a huge opportunity to purge that low quality, thin content that isn't doing anyone any good. I think there was that initial wave of, oh, you need a blog, you need to publish every day. You know, that's not necessarily the case, and it can do a whole lot more harm than good. So I think for people to revisit their post within analytics and to really gauge, okay, what's valuable here and what's just dead weight, and to start to purge some of those pages is really, really rewarding as well.
I love it. Cut the dead weight. That's a great purge. Yeah. I think anybody can do that. And also purge the notion that you need to do quantity over quality.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. Awesome.
It doesn't get much better than this. Brittany is a total nerd for online marketing. We're talking scientific experiments, Harvard-level machine learning courses, and much more. Now, I love the Jumpstart podcast because it gives me the opportunity to talk with experts on topics that I've only dabbled in understanding. Brittany is constantly learning new things, and it's translated into a budding career in the SEO field. And we're just getting started. Rumor has it that Brittany is an awesome speaker as well and was voted among the top presentations at MozCon 2017. What can't she do? At this point, it looks like nothing will get in the way of her success. Thanks for the chat, Brittany. I look forward to seeing you again at the Minnesota State Fair, aka the Great Minnesota Sweat Together, or some other kind of Minnesota conference that comes up that we can both be at. Maybe MN Search 2018, just putting that out there. For show notes, visit jefflytics.com/Brittany.